officials warned the New York Times' Nicholas Kristof that the very presence of our forces in the Pashtun areas is the problem, and a build-up would only prove to the Pashtuns that the Taliban are correct. The basic ignorance by our leadership is going to cause the deaths of many fine American troops with no positive outcome. One of the four, Howard Hart, former CIA station chief in Pakistan, campaigned for rapid withdrawal of U.S. forces. He told students at the University of Virginia that the United States could send hundreds of thousands of troops and spend umpteen billion dollars, and it would still do no good. "They will never stop fighting us," Hart said. "They never stopped fighting the Soviets. They've never stopped fighting each other." Not only did Afghans hate the presence of invading forces, they hated their tactics, especially in the heightened counterinsurgency phase of the war. Afghans resented night raids in which U.S. and Afghan troops forced their way into people's homes, kicking in doors, and breaking Afghan taboos about invading the privacy of women. The night raids, which increased exponentially once Obama took office, targeted Taliban leaders and suspected insurgents in an attempt to destroy the Taliban shadow governments that function throughout the country. What the Israeli geographer Eyal Wiseman said about such tactics in Palestine and Iraq applies equally, if not more so, in Afghanistan. Unexpected penetration of war into the private domain of the home has been experienced by civilians in Palestine, just like in Iraq, as the most profound form of trauma and humiliation. And to make matters worse, nighttime raids, like the drones, often mistakenly targeted innocent civilians. In May 2011, a midnight NATO raid on a home outside Jalalabad killed a local policeman, mistakenly identified as a Taliban leader. Troops also killed his 12-year-old niece, Nilofar, who was sleeping outside in the courtyard to escape from the sweltering indoor heat. A NATO official promptly apologized for the tragic accident. Nilofar's grieving father took little comfort in the apology. "They killed my 12-year-old innocent daughter and my brother-in-law and then told me, 'We are sorry,' he said. 'What does it mean? What pain can be cured by this word, sorry?" That the homegrown Taliban were guilty of killing more civilians than the foreign invaders that year did nothing to mitigate Afghans' anger toward NATO forces. Reports surfaced repeatedly of American soldiers who went over the line, gratuitously killing innocent civilians in Afghanistan, as was earlier the case in Iraq. One 20-year-old soldier, who went AWOL in Canada, described the process that led to the erosion of human empathy. "I swear I could not for a second view these people as anything but human. The best way to fashion a young hard dick like myself," Dick being an acronym for Dedicated Infantry Combat Killer, "is simple and the effect of racist indoctrination. Take an empty shell off the streets of L.A. or Brooklyn, or maybe from some podunk town in Tennessee, and these days America isn't in short supply. I was one of those No Child Left Behind products. Anyway, you take this empty vessel and you scare the living shit out of him. Break him down to nothing. Cultivate a brotherhood and camaraderie with those he suffers with, and fill his head with racist nonsense like, 'All Arabs, Iraqis, Afghans are Hajj. Hajj hates you. Hajj wants to hurt your family. Hajj children the worst because they beg all the time.' Just some of the most hurtful and ridiculous propaganda. But you'd be amazed at how effective it's been in fostering my generation of soldiers." One group of deranged young men formed a 12-person kill team that murdered innocent Afghans and then staged evidence to make it look as if they acted in self-defense. One of the accused confessed to the murders. U.S. authorities were not pleased when photos of the soldiers posing with the corpses appeared in Der Spiegel. The damage done by American troop presence was only exacerbated by the deplorable behavior of Afghan leaders. When Matthew Ho, a senior U.S. diplomat in Afghanistan's Zabul province, who had previously served as a Marine Corps captain in Iraq, resigned in September 2009, he wrote that Karzai's government is awash in glaring corruption and unabashed graft, and that Karzai is A president whose confidants and chief advisors comprise drug lords and war crimes villains, who mock our own rule of law and counter-narcotics effort. Ambassador Eikenberry, too, opposed throwing dollars and arms at the notoriously corrupt Karzai regime, headed by Karzai's friends, family members, and political allies, who gorged themselves on the money that poured into the impoverished country, and warlords who were just as brutal, repressive, misogynistic, and undemocratic as the Taliban who preceded them. Men who former Afghan parliament member and human rights crusader Malalai Joya described as photocopies of the Taliban. The Economist reported that in parts of Afghanistan, where insurgents have been driven out and the writ of the government has been restored, residents have sometimes hankered for the warlords, who were less venal and less brutal than Mr. Karzai's lot. In 2010, Transparency International ranked Afghanistan the world's second most corrupt nation behind Somalia, and two spots ahead of Iraq. The UN reported that in 2009, Afghans spent $2.5 billion to bribe police and government officials, which equaled approximately a quarter of Afghanistan's legitimate gross domestic product. The bribes averaged out to $158 per capita, a substantial amount in a country where the average annual GDP is only $426. The November 2010 release of part of the quarter million confidential diplomatic cables obtained by WikiLeaks proved quite revealing and profoundly embarrassing. Corruption was pervasive, engulfing almost everyone in leadership positions. Karzai's anti-corruption czar, Izzatullah Wasifi, spent 4 years in a U.S. jail for selling heroin in Las Vegas. Karzai worked hard to protect family members and supporters, often seeing that charges were dropped even when they were caught red-handed. The Commerce Minister told diplomats that the Transportation Ministry collected $200 million per year in trucking fees, but only $30 million of that total ended up in government coffers. People pay up to $250,000 to get jobs overseeing these operations. The American Embassy in Kabul reported that Afghanistan's first vice president from 2004 to 2009, Ahmad Zia Massoud, was found by customs officials to be carrying $52 million in cash when he visited the United Arab Emirates in 2009. Massoud denied the charges, but didn't explain how, on a salary of a few hundred dollars a month, he could afford to live in a waterfront house alongside other Afghan officials in Palm Jumeirah, a luxury Dubai community. Another cable acknowledged that Ahmed Wali Karzai, the president's half-brother and the most powerful man in Kandahar before his assassination in July 2011, who had long been on the CIA payroll, was widely understood to be corrupt and a narcotics trafficker. Other Hamid Karzai allies also gorged on the drug trade. British forces caught the governor of Helmand with 20,000 pounds of opium in his office. Though ousted from the governorship, he was later appointed to the Senate. The Taliban had actually done a good job keeping the drug trade under control when they were in power. But following the U.S. invasion, drugs had proliferated wildly. Opium production skyrocketed from 185 tons in 2001 to 8,200 tons in 2007, constituting 53% of the entire national economy and employing nearly 20% of the Afghan population. The drug lords lived in opulent carnival-colored mansions called poppy palaces that were distinguished by their non-Afghan narcotecture styles. But many Afghans suffered from the resulting drug abuse. In 2005, 920,000 addicts were reported. The number increased substantially after that. Under Karzai, illicit drugs provided a steady flow of funds for the Taliban, who taxed them at a rate of 10% and protected drug convoys for an additional fee. The Taliban also received hundreds of millions of dollars indirectly from the United States and NATO. Journalist Gene McKenzie reported that in much of the country, contractors factored at least a 20% cut on projects to the Taliban to let them proceed. One Afghan contractor reported, "I was building a bridge. The local Taliban commander called and said, "Don't build a bridge there, we'll have to blow it up." I asked him to let me finish the bridge, collect the money, then they could blow it up whenever they wanted. We agreed, and I completed my project. In 2010, American officials paid $2.2 billion to U.S. and Afghan trucking companies to transport supplies to U.S. bases. These trucking companies hired security firms that were often linked to top government officials to protect the trucks for between $800 and $2,500 per truck. The security firms, in turn, often faked fights to magnify the need for their services and bribed the Taliban to let the trucks pass without attacking them, leading one NATO official in Kabul to complain, "We're funding both sides of the war." Karzai's brother, Mahmoud, was exonerated by a commission appointed by Hamid Karzai to look into the massive fraud at Kabul Bank, the country's largest, where powerful insiders and shareholders received $925 million in loans, often without either collateral or documentation. Among the recipients were government ministers and members of parliament. The commission reported that Mahmoud Karzai had paid back his loans, although a central bank governor informed parliament that Karzai still owed $22 million. He wasn't the only well-connected brother implicated. Abdul Hassan Fahim, the brother of the country's powerful first vice president, owed over $100 million, but assured the commission that he would pledge enough property to cover that amount. In June 2011, Abdul Qadir Fitrat, the governor of Afghanistan's central bank, resigned and fled the country. He had come under increasing attack by Karzai's allies in the wake of his testimony to parliament and subsequent investigation into the bank fraud, and feared for his life. Afghanistan's attorney general brought charges against him. The allegations were supported by commission chairman Azizulaluddin, who had earlier served Karzai as head of the Independent Electoral Commission that gave its stamp of approval to the hotly contested 2009 presidential elections, which was universally condemned as fraudulent. The extent of vote fraud in that and other elections had proved an outright embarrassment to the United States and NATO. The UN's Electoral Complaints Commission threw out more than 1 million votes, 28% of Karzai's total. Deputy UN Envoy Peter Galbraith declared, "The fraud has handed the Taliban its greatest strategic victory in 8 years of fighting the United States and its Afghan partners." When the Afghan parliament subsequently rejected Karzai's attempt to replace the three foreign members of the five-member commission with hand-picked Afghans, Karzai threatened to join the Taliban. Outright buying of votes is so pervasive in Afghanistan that it was barely hidden during the September 2010 parliamentary elections. Votes that cost as little as $1 in Kandahar might go for $18 in eastern Ghazni province. Most were in the $5 to $6 range, and with only 2,500 votes needed to win in certain districts, this seemed like a sound investment. The New York Times explained, "Many well-heeled Afghan independent candidates are looking to buy their way into the lucrative sinecure of a seat in parliament. That not only comes with a healthy salary, about $2,200 a month gross, but tremendous opportunities for graft." Registration cards for female voters were in particularly high demand, both because they didn't contain photographs and because men often voted for women who were not permitted to leave the house. Much of this corruption and fraud was well known to Obama while he was trying to decide which course of action to pursue in Afghanistan. On November 25, 2009, he met with Rahm Emanuel, National Security Advisor General Jones, and Jones's deputy Thomas Donilon, and expressed his frustration. "It'd be a lot easier for me to go out and give a speech saying, 'You know what? The American people are sick of this war, and we're going to put in 10,000 trainers because that's how we're going to get out of there.'" Woodward contends that was precisely what Obama wanted to say, if he had the courage to stand up to his military advisors. "It's not the number," Biden explained. "It's the strategy." Still wavering, Obama met with close National Security Council advisors over Thanksgiving weekend to weigh his options. "I don't see how you can defy your military chain here," Army Colonel John Tien warned him, implying that his entire military high command, Mullen, Petraeus, McChrystal, and Gates, might resign in protest. Donilon and CIA Director Leon Panetta had been expressing similar views. No democratic president can go against military advice, especially if he asked for it, Panetta admonished. So just do it, he recommended. Do what they say. Seeing that Obama was again being forced into a corner against his better judgment, General Douglas Lute, the NSC coordinator for Afghanistan and Pakistan, reminded him, Mr. President, you don't have to do this. Just the day before, Colin Powell had offered the same advice. You don't have to put up with this, he told the president. You're the commander-in-chief. These guys work for you. Because they're unanimous in their advice doesn't make it right. There are other generals. There's only one commander-in-chief. When it finally came down to decision time, Obama didn't have the courage or integrity of a post-Cuban Missile Crisis John F. Kennedy. He settled on a 30,000 troop increase, giving the military leaders almost everything they wanted and more than they expected. Borrowing a page from the Bush guidelines on patriotic atmospherics, Obama chose West Point for his December 1st speech, outlining plans to increase U.S. troop levels to around 100,000. He explained that the United States and its allies had invaded Afghanistan because it had provided sanctuary for Al-Qaeda, which was responsible for 9/11. He forgot to mention at least three crucial facts. First, only 50 to 100 of Al-Qaeda's worldwide total of 300 cadre were actually in Afghanistan, while the rest of its badly degraded force operated out of Pakistan and received most of its support from citizens of U.S.-backed regimes in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Yemen, and the United Arab Emirates. Second, Taliban leader Mullah Omar had actually opposed the 9/11 attack against U.S. targets. According to the official report of the 9/11 Commission, as final preparations were underway during the summer of 2001, dissent emerged among Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan over whether to proceed. The Taliban's chief, Mullah Omar, opposed attacking the United States. Although facing opposition from many of his senior lieutenants, bin Laden effectively overruled their objections, and the attacks went forward. And third, terrorists didn't need a safe haven replete with training camps to conduct clandestine operations. As Paul Pillar, the former deputy chief of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, pointed out, the operations most important to future terrorist attacks do not need such a home, and few recruits are required for even very deadly terrorism. Consider, the preparations most important to the September 11, 2001 attacks took place not in training camps in Afghanistan, but rather in apartments in Germany, hotel rooms in Spain, and flight schools in the United States. Obama's logic befuddled CNN commentator Fareed Zakaria. If Al-Qaeda is down to 100 men there at the most, why are we fighting a major war? Citing the 100 NATO troops who had been killed the previous month and the $100 billion plus annual cost, he determined that the war was costing more than one allied death for each living Al-Qaeda member in the country in just 1 month, and $1 billion for every member of Al-Qaeda thought to be living in Afghanistan in 1 year. In response to those who justified the war because the Taliban were allies of Al-Qaeda, Zakaria observed, "This would be like fighting Italy in World War II after Hitler's regime had collapsed and Berlin was in flames, just because Italy had been allied with Germany." Jim Lacey of the Marine Corps War College made his own calculations, based on the 140,000 coalition soldiers, and determined the cost was actually $1.5 billion annually per Al-Qaeda member in Afghanistan. Did anyone do the math? Lacey wondered. In what universe do we find strategists to whom this makes sense? Historian Andrew Basevich pointed out the most glaring contradiction. If Afghanistan was really so critical to U.S. safety and security, which he considered a preposterous notion, then why set limits on U.S. involvement there? Why not send 100,000 troops rather than 30,000? Why not vow to do whatever it takes rather than signal an early exit? Why not raise taxes and reinstate the draft? Why not promise victory? A word missing from the president's address. And the price tag was indeed astronomical and climbing. In 2006, congressional researchers estimated that it cost $390,000 per soldier per year in Afghanistan. By 2009, the figure had climbed to $1 million per year because of the heightened cost of mine-resistant troop carriers and surveillance equipment and the $400 per gallon cost of delivering fuel through insurgent thick and forbidding mountainous terrain. Obama tried to mollify his progressive supporters by announcing that troop withdrawals would begin July 2011, with all troops out by 2014. In The Promise, Jonathan Alter reported that Obama said to Petraeus and Mullen, "I want you to be honest with me. You can do this in 18 months?" Petraeus replied, "Sir, I'm confident we can train and hand over to the ANA, Afghan National Army, in that time frame." Obama pressed further, "If you can't do the things you say you can in 18 months, then no one is going to suggest we stay, right?" Petraeus assured him, "Yes, sir, in agreement." And Mullen chimed in, "Yes, sir." But, as Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank wryly observed, President Obama's 18-month deadline for starting the Afghanistan pullout didn't survive its first 18 hours. Administration officials testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee the day after Obama's speech made clear that the pullout date was only aspirational. Gates set the tone when he testified, "Our current plan is that we will begin the transition in July of 2011. We will evaluate in December 2010 whether we believe we will be able to meet that objective." Gates informed senators that the president had the prerogative to change his mind. Mullen agreed. Hillary Clinton added, "I do not believe we have locked ourselves into leaving." In May 2010, at a dinner that Clinton hosted for Karzai and some top cabinet ministers, Gates assured the Afghans, "We're not leaving Afghanistan prematurely. In fact," he added, "we're not ever leaving at all." Indeed, the Pentagon was planning to keep 10,000 to 30,000 troops in Afghanistan and believed it was in a strong position to get its way because of Afghan dependence on foreign aid. Withdrawal was contingent upon training, arming, and equipping an ANA and police force that could provide security. McChrystal lobbied for a combined force of 400,000. Estimates of the annual cost of maintaining an Afghan security force that size ran to around $10 billion, but Afghan tax revenues only totaled some $2 billion, and three-quarters of the national budget came from foreign aid, leading John Kerry to ask, "So who will pay the bills to avoid having those armed soldiers and police mobilized as part of the next insurgency?" Internal government reviews made clear that building such a force was a daunting, if not impossible, task. After years of training, few Afghan army or police units could function independently, and leadership was lacking at all levels. Lieutenant General William Caldwell, the American who headed the NATO effort to train Afghan forces, reported in 2011 that 30% of Afghan soldiers deserted every year, with the highest rates in the combat areas where they were most needed. A comparable percentage left the police each year. Caldwell put the literacy rate of Army recruits at around 10%. Corruption ran rampant. Conditions were deplorable. Afghan soldiers damaged new buildings by tearing sinks off the walls to wash their feet before praying, or building fires on barrack floors for cooking and heating in buildings that already contained kitchens and furnaces. Repairs were time-consuming and costly. Another issue was motivation. As Thomas Friedman observed in chiding Obama for not having the courage to reject a war that neither he nor his advisors wanted, "You know you're in trouble," he wrote, "when you're in a war in which the only party whose objectives are clear, whose rhetoric is consistent, and whose will to fight never seems to diminish, is your enemy, the Taliban." "Why," he asked, "do we have to recruit and train our allies, the Afghan army, to fight? If there is one thing Afghan males should not need to be trained to do, it's to engage in warfare. That may be the only thing they all know how to do after 30 years of civil war and centuries of resisting foreign powers. After all, who is training the Taliban? They've been fighting the U.S. Army to a draw, and many of their commanders can't even read." Those who wondered what government forces were doing, if not reading or fighting, got some disturbing insight in January 2011, when the Afghan government signed an agreement with the UN to stop recruiting children into the police force and to ban the common and, according to the Washington Post, growing practice of using young boys as sex slaves. The New York Times reported that, as part of the Afghan tradition of bashabazi, literally boy play, boys as young as 9 are dressed as girls and trained to dance for male audiences, then prostituted in an auction to the highest bidder. Many powerful men, particularly commanders in the military and the police, keep such boys, often dressed in uniforms, as constant companions for sexual purposes. In Afghanistan, bashabazi had actually become rampant among the insurgent mujahideen during their U.S.-backed campaign to oust Soviet forces. It was most openly practiced around Kandahar, where the Times noted the Taliban originally came to prominence when they intervened in a fight between two pedophile warlords over the possession of a coveted dancing boy. The Taliban had banned this practice when they were in power. While Afghan commanders cavorted, American troops were paying a tremendous price, both physically and psychologically. A study by doctors at the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, where most wounded troops stopped before returning to the United States, found a dramatic increase in the percentage of injured troops who had lost limbs between 2009 and 2010 due to the widespread use of improvised explosive devices, IEDs. In 2010, 11% of the casualties had undergone amputations. 38% of the amputees had undergone multiple amputations. Among the most gruesome were injuries to the genitals and urinary tract, the number of which almost tripled in just 1 year. Retired Army Colonel Dr. John Holcomb, who had had extensive combat medicine experience, called the findings of the study unbelievable. Everybody was taken aback by the frequency of these injuries, the double amputations, the injuries to the penis and testicles, said Holcomb. Nothing like this has been seen before. Some injuries were going underreported. By mid-2010, the military reported 115,000 troops had suffered mild traumatic brain injuries from shockwaves from roadside bombs. The injuries could cause long-term mental and physical damage. An investigation by ProPublica and National Public Radio discovered that such injuries were far more pervasive than the military indicated, and that tens of thousands of other sufferers had gone uncounted. The psychological toll was also profound. In November 2009, Secretary of Veterans Affairs Eric Shinseki noted that more veterans have committed suicide since 2001 than we have lost on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan. Joseph Stiglitz and Harvard public policy professor Linda Bilmes reported in 2010 that 600,000 of the 2.1 million who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan had sought medical treatment from the Department of Veterans Affairs, and that 500,000 had applied for disability benefits, which was approximately 30% higher than initially estimated. With treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and other health issues only increasing over time, and life expectancy rising, they estimated that the real cost of both wars could top $4 trillion. Considering that 9/11 cost Al-Qaeda approximately $50,000, the multi-trillion-dollar U.S. response was indeed playing into bin Laden's goal of bankrupting the United States. Given the fundamental illogic of fighting a decade-long and immensely costly war in Afghanistan in order to defeat a debilitated enemy that was based in Pakistan, some concluded the United States must have an ulterior motive. They found a possible answer in 2010, when the Pentagon announced that its team of geologists and other investigators had confirmed the existence of vast Afghan mineral resources. The Pentagon projected that Afghanistan could become the Saudi Arabia of lithium, a crucial ingredient in batteries for various electronic devices. London banker Ian Hannam, a mining expert with J.P. Morgan, went further, drooling over the prospect that Afghanistan could be one of the leading producers of copper, gold, lithium and iron ore in the world. Petraeus, who would shortly replace McChrystal as commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, agreed. "There is stunning potential here," he said. Afghan officials estimated mineral worth at $3 trillion, a truly staggering figure for a country whose gross domestic product was around $12 billion, and whose economy consisted largely of narcotics and foreign aid. Despite all the hoopla surrounding this discovery, Afghanistan's mineral wealth was hardly a surprise. In January 1911, the Chicago Daily Tribune reported that Afghanistan is rich in natural resources. It produces copper, lead, iron, and even gold. In 1928, the newly formed Afghan-American Trading Company announced that it had acquired exclusive concessions to exploit Afghanistan's oil and minerals. Little had been done to extract these resources in subsequent years, but both Afghans and foreign investors knew that day would eventually arrive. While Western investors waited for the security situation to stabilize before descending on the region, the resource-hungry Chinese pounced. A Chinese state-owned firm secured the rights to a copper mine in eastern Afghanistan. The Afghan minister who negotiated the deal, Mohammed Ibrahim Adel, was ousted after being accused of accepting a $30 million bribe from the Chinese. He had been appointed by President Karzai in March 2006, when his predecessor refused to privatize the Gori cement factory, Afghanistan's only operating cement plant, when approached by Mahmoud Karzai. Adel's first act was selling the factory to Karzai's Afghan investment company. His last was accepting the bribe from China's Metallurgical Group Corporation. Investors also salivated over the potential energy resources in Central Asia. Atop that list was natural gas in Turkmenistan, which had potentially the fifth largest gas field yet discovered. Regional governments envisioned transporting that gas via a pipeline running through Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the Pakistanis were maneuvering to undercut both the United States and India and make Pakistan the principal player in Afghanistan. They decided to exploit the growing rift between the United States and Karzai, who said he no longer felt the United States and NATO could win militarily and would eventually withdraw. Top Pakistani officials met repeatedly with Karzai, offering to deliver key Taliban leaders, including Sirajuddin Haqqani, Mullah Muhammad Omar, and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, for a power-sharing arrangement that would end the conflict. Karzai's ouster of intelligence chief Amrullah Saleh and interior minister Hanif Atmar, both of whom had opposed such negotiations with Taliban fighters, showed that he too was interested, as was most of the country's Pashtun population. However, such negotiations were fiercely opposed by the country's more pro-American Tajik, Uzbek, and Hazara communities, who constituted almost half the population. Having suffered the most during the reign of the Pashtun Taliban, they now constituted the most aggressive fighters in the ANA, and their adamant opposition to such a deal raised the specter of civil war. After a decade of wasting blood and treasure, the American people had finally wearied of this futile war. In March 2011, an ABC News Washington Post poll indicated that two-thirds of Americans did not believe the Afghanistan war was worth fighting. 1 year later, CNN reported, opposition had jumped to 72%. Among the fiercest critics were the nation's mayors, who had seen their cities undergo draconian cuts due to declining revenues and shrinking federal aid. When they gathered in Baltimore in June 2011 for the annual meeting of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, they let the administration know how they felt. They called for a speedy end to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and for using the $126 billion annual savings to rebuild the nation's cities. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa of Los Angeles said that the notion that we would build bridges in Baghdad and Kandahar, and not Baltimore and Kansas City, absolutely boggles the mind. The pressure to leave had increased dramatically on May 1, 2011, when Navy SEALs killed Osama bin Laden, who was living comfortably in a home in Abbottabad, Pakistan, in the shadow of Pakistan's premier military academy. Believing Pakistani officials must have known of bin Laden's whereabouts, Many Americans demanded that aid be cut off. Mistrust of Pakistani leaders ran so deep that the United States did not alert them that they had found bin Laden or were planning the attack, fearing that they would tip him off. The raid proved to be a huge embarrassment to Pakistan, whose government was only a notch more stable than that of neighboring Afghanistan. U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan, Ann Patterson, had reported in early 2010, "Pakistan's civilian government remains weak, ineffectual, and corrupt. President Asif Ali Zardari, America's principal ally, had earlier confided to Biden that the army and ISI, Pakistan's real power brokers, might take me out. Army Chief General Ashfaq Parvez Kayani was also in a tenuous position, facing a challenge from officers objecting to his ties to the United States. Under pressure, Kayani announced that Pakistan would no longer cooperate with U.S. drone attacks against insurgents operating from within Pakistan, and would greatly restrict the latitude of U.S. intelligence operatives within the country. Relations between the allies were dealt a further blow in November 2011, when a NATO air attack killed 24 Pakistani troops. When U.S. officials refused to apologize, the Pakistani government shut down supply routes to Afghanistan, forcing NATO to rely upon slower and more costly alternatives. The following May, a Pakistani court convicted a Pakistani doctor of treason for assisting the CIA in tracking down bin Laden and sentenced him to 33 years in prison. The U.S. Senate immediately retaliated by voting to cut $33 million in military aid on top of the $1.2 billion it was already withholding. Pakistan finally reopened the routes in early July 2012, after extracting an apology from Secretary of State Clinton. In Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike used bin Laden's assassination to press for rapid withdrawal from Afghanistan. Richard Lugar, the ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, argued that it was no longer clear why we're there, and rejected the idea that the United States should be involved in such grand nation-building. Senator Dick Durbin, the Democratic Party whip, concurred. "If you believe that resolution of this conflict by military means is highly unlikely, and not a realistic basis for U.S. policy, how can we send one more American soldier to fight and die in Afghanistan?" he asked. The rift between the United States and the Karzai government also continued to widen. In mid-June 2011, Karzai denounced coalition forces in an address to the Afghanistan Youth International Conference. "You remember a few years ago I was saying thank you to the foreigners for their help. Every minute we were thanking them," he said. "Now I have stopped saying that. They're here for their own purposes, for their own goals, and they're using our soil for that," he complained in the nationally televised broadcast. Karzai cited not only the mounting civilian casualties caused by NATO bombing, but also the environmental damage, singling out the effect of depleted uranium weapons. A few weeks earlier, Karzai had expressed outrage at a NATO bombing that killed several children and other civilians and threatened to take unilateral action against NATO if it continued to bomb Afghan homes. "If they continue their attacks on our houses," he warned, "history shows what Afghans do with trespassers and with occupiers." U.S. officials were taken aback by such ingratitude. Outgoing Ambassador Eikenberry responded, "When we hear ourselves being called occupiers and worse, and our generous aid programs dismissed as totally ineffective and the source of all corruption, our pride is offended, and we begin to lose our inspiration to carry on." Chastened by the angry response to his indelicate remarks, Karzai watched his words more carefully for a few months. But in October, he again infuriated his U.S. backers by telling a Pakistani journalist that, "If war ever breaks out between Pakistan and America, we will side with Pakistan. I don't want any American soldier entering Afghans' homes anymore." Nor, as Senator Durbin suggested, was a military solution in the offing. Troop surge or no troop surge. In July and August 2011 alone, the Taliban assassinated 181 high-ranking Afghan government officials, including Ahmed Wali Karzai. Other recent victims included Kandahar's mayor, the head of Kandahar's religious council, one of President Karzai's close advisors, and peace negotiator and former president Burhanuddin Rabbani. In late July 2012, NATO released data showing that the number of insurgent attacks over the past 3 months had actually increased by 11% over the previous year, exposing the hollowness of repeated claims of success in defeating the insurgency. Bad news kept pouring out of the country. In September, Human Rights Watch reported that U.S.-trained and funded members of the Afghan local police, ALP, forces, and militias, known as Arbakai, had been abusing the villagers they were supposed to be protecting. Documented abuses included murder, rape, abductions, arbitrary detention, and forcible land grabs. Building up such forces was key to U.S. plans to stabilize the country. Petraeus had told the U.S. Senate that the ALP is arguably the most critical element in our effort to help Afghanistan develop the capability to secure itself. The other pillar of future stability, the Afghan National Police, ANP, was just as bad. Less than a month after the devastating Human Rights Watch report appeared, the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan found compelling evidence that the Afghan Intelligence Service, the National Directorate of Security, and the ANP were subjecting detainees, including children under the age of 18, to systematic torture during interrogation. Among the abuses highlighted in the report were twisting prisoners' genitals until they passed out, suspending them by their wrists and beating them with cables and rubber hoses, removing their toenails, subjecting them to electric shock and stress positions, and threatening them with sexual assault. The United Nations Drug Control Agency reported that NATO efforts to slow the Afghan drug trade were failing. Opium poppy cultivation was up in 2011 for a second straight year, despite a 65% increase in anti-drug efforts in 2011. 7% more land was under cultivation, and due to soaring prices, the expanded crop was bringing in $1.4 billion, double what it had the previous year. Cultivation, like the insurgency itself, had spread to the northern and eastern provinces from which it had previously been absent. Attacks on eradication teams had quadrupled from the previous year. Foreshadowing what would eventually be a miserable end to the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, in October 2011, Obama announced that U.S. troops would be out of Iraq by year's end. The December 31st departure date had actually been negotiated by George W. Bush in 2008. Still, Obama took credit for fulfilling his campaign promise, and the majority of Americans applauded the end of the Iraq debacle. Many within the Pentagon, however, found the announcement infuriating. After earlier insisting that a force of between 10,000 and 20,000 remain, military leaders had lowered their sights to between 3,000 and 5,000. They joined Obama and Clinton in pressuring the Iraqis to grant immunity from prosecution to U.S. troops remaining in the country. But, unmoved, the Shiite bloc in parliament, led by Muqtada al-Sadr, refused, and the final drawdown began. To be sure, that would not entirely end U.S. presence in Iraq. The State Department estimated that as many as 16,000 or 17,000 U.S. personnel might remain, including 5,500 armed military contractors. The world's largest U.S. embassy, a 104-acre walled compound in Baghdad, and consulates in Basra and Erbil, would remain as constant reminders to Iraqis of U.S. invasion, devastation, conquest, and occupation. Colonel John S. Lascote, commander of an army brigade that was assisting the State Department during the transition period, noted that the Department of State is establishing its largest mission in its history. Senator John Kerry worried that the United States was replacing a military presence with a private mercenary presence. The smaller number of remaining troops would oversee the $10 billion in U.S. contracts to arm the Iraqi military with tanks, fighter jets, and other weapons, $3 billion of which the U.S. government was paying for. The United States was also spending close to $1 billion per year to train the Iraqi police. The final tally would be almost 4,500 U.S. troops killed and more than 32,000 wounded. Tens of thousands more suffered from PTSD and other psychological ailments. Estimates of Iraqi deaths ranged from 150,000 to over 1 million. In October 2006, a team of U.S. and Iraqi epidemiologists reported 655,000 excess Iraqi deaths resulting from the U.S. invasion. The United States had spent close to $1 trillion, but that was a small down payment on what the final cost would amount to. Obama welcomed the troops home at Fort Bragg. But instead of honestly treating the Iraq War as the unmitigated disaster it had been for the United States, drawing some poignant lessons, and thanking those gathered for their sacrifice, Obama felt compelled to cloak the war's end in the kind of patriotic drivel that conjured up the powerfully haunting words of Rudyard Kipling, the erstwhile proponent of empire, who had convinced his son to enlist in the First World War, only to have him die his first day of combat. In his Epitaphs of the War, Kipling wrote, "If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied." Obama's lies would sear just as deeply and painfully. "We're leaving behind a sovereign, stable, and self-reliant Iraq, with a representative government that was elected by its people," he told the troops, praising their extraordinary achievement. "The most important lesson," he declared, "was about our national character, that there's nothing we Americans can't do when we stick together. And that's why the United States military is the most respected institution in our land." He commended their willingness to sacrifice so much for a people that you had never met, which, he insisted, was part of what makes us special as Americans. "Unlike the old empires, we don't make these sacrifices for territory or for resources. We do it because it's right. There can be no fuller expression of America's support for self-determination than our leaving Iraq to its people. That says something about who we are." Having rewritten the history of Iraq, he turned to Afghanistan, claiming that the troops had also broken the momentum of the Taliban. The wars, he assured them, had made America stronger and the world more secure. Reaching deep into the repository of America's sacred myths, he saluted the source of U.S. greatness, the values that are written into our founding documents, and a unique willingness among nations to pay a great price for the progress of human freedom and dignity. "This is who we are. That's what we do as Americans, together." He reminded them that they were part of an unbroken line of heroes spanning two centuries, from the colonists who overthrew an empire, to your grandparents and parents who faced down fascism and communism, to you, men and women who fought for the same principles in Fallujah and Kandahar, and delivered justice to those who attacked us on 9/11. One would be hard-pressed to know where to begin dissecting the distortions and debunking the myths, but as we have shown throughout these pages, the notions of American altruism, benevolence, and self-sacrifice might be a good place to start, especially when combined with an explicit disavowal of interest in territories and resources. Obama identified America's uniqueness among nations as its willingness to pay a great price for the progress of human freedom and dignity. The wars, he absurdly claimed, had made the United States stronger and the world more secure. He compared the troops who had slaughtered hundreds of Iraqi civilians in Fallujah to the American colonists who overthrew an empire, and to the World War II generation who faced down fascism. Perhaps he hadn't seen the American flag-burning jubilation of Fallujah's crowds during their Day of Resistance and Freedom that commemorated the U.S. departure from Iraq. Perhaps he hadn't read the accounts by U.S. Marines of wanton and often indiscriminate killing of Iraqi civilians, including women and children in Haditha and elsewhere throughout the country. Perhaps he hadn't seen the commander of U.S. forces in Anbar Province's explanation of why he didn't investigate U.S. troops' random killing of 24 Iraqi civilians in Haditha. It happened all the time, he explained, throughout the whole country. And in what was either the most contemptible lie since the early days of the Bush administration, or unfortunately sloppy and careless phrasing, Obama congratulated the troops for having fought for the same principles in Fallujah and Kandahar, and delivered justice to those who attacked us on 9/11, adding credence to the Bush-Cheney fabrication that the invasion of Iraq was somehow justified by Saddam's support for al-Qaeda, and perpetuating the dangerous illusion that the occupation of either country, as of 2011, had anything at all to do with that initial al-Qaeda attack. The words were barely out of Obama's mouth before stable Iraq fell back into chaos. Within days, the country was racked with a series of suicide bombings that left scores dead and hundreds injured, and the country on the verge of relapse into civil war. Sunnis were feeling particularly aggrieved. The coalition government that U.S. officials had finally managed to cobble together nearly 8 months after the 2010 election had effectively collapsed. Prime Minister Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, a Shiite, had issued an arrest warrant for Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi, a Sunni, charging him with running a death squad out of his office, and had tried to unseat the Sunni deputy prime minister. Hashimi fled to the Kurdish region to escape arrest. Maliki's security forces had already arrested hundreds of Sunni opposition leaders and former Ba'athists in recent weeks, while Maliki tightened his control over the army and police. Opponents accused him of becoming a dictator. Sunnis and secular critics boycotted parliament. For months, Sunni provinces had been demanding greater autonomy, along the lines the Kurds had established in oil-rich Kurdistan, which had its own parliament, president, and security forces. The country threatened to split into three separate regions. Iraqi disdain for the American sacrifice that had disposed of a hated dictator, but resulted in death and wounding of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians, was reflected in the fact that most senior Iraqis who were invited to what the Washington Post described as a seemingly endless process of military ceremonies did not attend. The United States had actually stopped holding large base-closing ceremonies the previous spring because insurgents were using them as an opportunity to launch attacks. One gathering particularly stood out. On December 17th, U.S. and Iraqi officials assembled for a signing ceremony to turn Contingency Operating Base Adar, the last U.S. base in Iraq, which once housed 12,000 U.S. troops and contractors, over to the Iraqi Air Force. The Post's Greg Jaffe described the scene. First, a six-man Iraq band clad in dirty blue uniforms played a ragged marching song on dented trumpets and trombones. Following that, an Iraqi military officer cheered in Arabic, clapped and stomped his feet. Soon, the mostly Iraqi crowd was chanting and cheering with him. Jaffe noted that an American military officer sat stiffly on the stage behind a sign marked Colonel. The Iraqi speaker next shouted, "This is the end of the American occupation. May God have mercy on our martyrs." The remaining U.S. forces snuck off in the dead of night, in what the paper described as a secret pre-dawn convoy to Kuwait. The two wars had been unmitigated disasters. Even Gates, on some level, acknowledged the indefensibility of ever again plunging the United States into the invasion of another country. In February 2011, he told West Point cadets, "In my opinion, any future defense secretary who advises the president to again send a big American land army into Asia or into the Middle East or Africa should have his head examined," as General MacArthur so delicately put it. The consequences of years of misguided and short-sighted U.S. policies were coming home to roost around the world. Nowhere was this more apparent than in the Middle East, where the United States was largely relegated to the role of bystander, as the Arab Spring's extraordinary democratic upheaval was fundamentally transforming the region that the United States had done so much to shape. Decades of uncritically supporting Israel while arming, training, and propping up one Arab dictator after another, as well as the post-9/11 use of Egyptians, Libyans, and others as surrogate torturers, had stripped the United States of all moral authority. Its professions of democracy rang hollow. Nor could anyone take seriously U.S. outrage about repressive regimes using force against their citizens, after U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan had directly or indirectly been responsible for the killing and maiming of hundreds of thousands of civilians. Even the goodwill generated by Obama's Cairo speech proved short-lived. Gaith Alomari, executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine, spoke for activists throughout the region. "It's become fashionable now to diss the Americans," he said. "The prevalent mood now is to say that the United States is no longer relevant, that the Arab Spring is happening without the help of the United States." Former International Atomic Energy Agency director and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Mohammed Al-Baradei blamed the United States for decades of backwardness and repression throughout the region. "America," he charged, "is really pushing Egypt and pushing the whole Arab world into radicalization with this inept policy of supporting repression." United States support for regime change and the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya on the pretext of preventing threatened atrocities reeked of hypocrisy when stacked against prolonged U.S. inaction in the face of actual atrocities being perpetrated by governments in Bahrain, Yemen, Syria, and elsewhere, or fierce internal repression in Saudi Arabia, where Wahhabi extremists continued to fund al-Qaeda and other global jihadis. The lesson seemed to be that only U.S. allies were permitted to slaughter and repress their citizens. In fact, when criticizing repressive Middle Eastern regimes, Obama pointedly omitted mention of Saudi Arabia, whose reactionary monarchy the United States had propped up for six decades in return for Saudi oil. Saudi Arabia had long been the largest purchaser of advanced U.S. weaponry. The Wall Street Journal projected that the sale Obama approved in 2010 might top $60 billion. Now, with the Saudis helping thwart democratic reform throughout the region, intervening politically, monetarily, and in the case of Bahrain, even militarily, the United States proved itself an unreliable ally for those seeking progressive change. The United States was also trapped by its continued embrace of an Israeli government that had moved sharply to the right. Obama appeared to have more sympathy for the Palestinian position than his predecessors, and his choice of George Mitchell as special envoy to the Middle East raised hopes that the United States would support an even-handed settlement of the outstanding issues. Paramount among them was the presence of 500,000 Jewish settlers in Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. Compounding this problem was the Israeli blockade of Gaza following Hamas's election in 2006. Everyone, with the exception of Israel's right-wing government under Bibi Netanyahu and members of the conservative Israel lobby in the United States, recognized that this was not only unjust and untenable, but that it threatened the continuation of Israel's increasingly tenuous democracy. However, it was not Mitchell, but Dennis Ross, Obama's chief Middle East advisor, who prevailed in internal debates. Ross, a Wolfowitz protege and advisor to presidents going back to Reagan, was a staunch defender of Israel. In May 2011, King Abdullah II of Jordan complained that, "We get good responses from the State Department and Pentagon, but not from the White House, and we know the reason why is because of Dennis Ross." Ross and Mitchell were at odds over whether the United States should propose a comprehensive peace plan for the region. Mitchell thought it might put needed pressure on a Netanyahu government that continued its illegal settlements policy and resistance to a meaningful two-state solution. Ross argued against pressuring Israel. The well-organized Israel lobby, which exercised inordinate influence in the United States, endorsed that view. Frustrated by Obama's buckling to pressure from the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, Mitchell resigned in April 2011. The United States again expressed contempt for world opinion over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with its veto of the UN Security Council resolution condemning Israeli settlements on Palestinian territory, not only as illegal, but as an obstacle to peace. The resolution was sponsored by at least 130 nations and supported by all 14 other members of the Security Council. While the Obama administration sought to curry favor with AIPAC, the most conservative branch of the powerful Israel lobby, much of the world looked toward a UN vote to recognize an independent Palestinian state, despite the vociferous opposition of the United States and Israel. Though Israel and the United States managed to sidetrack that effort, the Israelis had grown increasously isolated. The ouster of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt and growing Turkish support for the Palestinians had cost Israel two of its closest regional allies. Islamists were on the rise throughout the region. Thomas Friedman blamed this on 50 years of Arab dictatorship, in which only Islamists were allowed to organize in mosques, while no independent, secular, democratic parties were allowed to develop in the political arena. The uprising in neighboring Syria against the brutal Assad regime, although a major setback to Iran and Hezbollah, added another element of instability on Israel's border, exacerbated by the danger that Syria's large stockpile of chemical weapons might fall into the hands of Islamic extremists. Still, Netanyahu and his right-wing allies remained intransigent, expanding settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, in defiance not only of Obama, but of universal opinion, and knowing full well that such actions would undermine the prospects for a two-state solution. Avraham Berg, former Speaker of the Israeli Knesset, wondered if Israeli leaders had any intention of finding an equitable resolution. Can we continue to exist without a perennial adversary, without being victims of persecution? He asked. Distinguished Israeli intellectual Zaev Sternhell provided an answer in an article in Haaretz, aptly titled, "Israeli Right Needs Perpetual War." It was war with Iran that most captivated the right-wing Israeli imagination. Israeli hawks tried to build support for an attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, which they alleged were being used to produce a nuclear bomb. There was good reason to make sure that Iran did not reach that point, particularly because it might trigger a nuclear arms race throughout the region, with Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Syria, and possibly others quickly following suit. In September 2011, Iran inaugurated the Middle East's first nuclear power plant at Bushehr, a Russian-built model. But other Middle Eastern nations were not far behind, with dozens of nuclear reactors set to come online beginning in 2017 or 2018. Iran insisted it had no intention to build a bomb and continued to allow international monitors into the country. Israel, on the other hand, was widely believed to possess some 200 nuclear weapons. The U.S. Intelligence Committee stood by its 2007 National Intelligence Estimate, which concluded that Iran had stopped working on nuclear weapons in 2003 and not restarted the program. U.S. officials warned the Israelis that a preemptive attack would not only likely fail to achieve the desired results, it could lead to disastrous and destabilizing consequences in the region and beyond. They hoped that strengthening sanctions against Iranian oil exports and Iran's central bank would quiet the demand for military action. Israel had come dangerously close to launching such an attack in 2010. In June 2011, Meir Dagan, who had headed the Israeli spy agency Mossad for 8 years before stepping down the previous September, revealed that he, Military Chief of Staff Gabi Ashkenazi, and Yuval Diskin, director of the Shin Bet Internal Security Agency, had managed to block such reckless behavior on the part of Netanyahu and Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak. But now that all three were out of office, Dagan feared what Israel's leaders might do. Dagan explained, "I decided to speak out because when I was in office, Diskin, Ashkenazi and I could block any dangerous adventure. Now I am afraid that there is no one to stop Bibi and Barak." Other reports indicated that President Shimon Peres, Israeli Defense Forces Senior Commander Gadi Eisenkot, and recently retired Chief of Military Intelligence Amos Yadlin had also opposed attacking Iran. A majority of Israelis also rejected a military strike. A November 2011 poll found that Only 43% of Israeli Jews backed an attack, although 90% believed that Iran would succeed in acquiring nuclear weapons. 64% supported turning the region into a nuclear-free zone, even though that would require Israel to give up its nuclear arsenal. The erosion of U.S. power and influence has also been obvious in Latin America, where, like in the Middle East, the effects of a century of supporting dictators who favored U.S. business and political interests over the well-being of their own people had resulted in a wave of anti-Americanism that swept the continent in the early years of the 21st century. Aside from tolerating the ousting of President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras, the United States had been largely unable to stop the leftist trends sweeping Central and South America. Even Colombia, the closest U.S. ally, had been reassessing its ties to the Colossus of the North. Since taking office in 2010, Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, has not only taken steps to reduce the enormous gap between Colombia's rich and poor, he has mended relations with Venezuela and Ecuador, and now calls Hugo Chavez his new best friend. In December 2011, Chavez convened a two-day summit of Latin American and Caribbean heads of state in Caracas. The colorful and controversial